Each failure is a step closer to success. You're listening to episode 9 of Learn With Us. I'm Ken.
And I'm Nikos. Learn With Us is a podcast for developers that want to be better programmers.
And who doesn't want to be a better programmer? I do. So, today we were going to talk about... Serverless...
Framework.
So, I don't know anything about serverless framework other than the magical Google and Microsoft and Amazon have different services that they have out there for it. What do you know, and what can you tell me, because I'm stupid.
Okay, so serverless framework is a node-based framework that allows you to deploy to the various cloud providers functionality that runs on function as a service platforms. So function as a service means that you have code or like business logic that does not run on a server that's up all the time. The code runs in response to an event, whether it be a browser event or a database event or a Institute of Things event or an S3 event. And there's some functionality. Now, the framework itself is called Serverless Framework, and you have a CLI that you use to create the project, and the project itself is installed via npm. So you do npm install -g serverless, if I remember correctly, and that will install the project to a global npm module. And then you have the CLI available, so what you can do is something like serverless create the name of the template. So that if you wanted to write a node based project, you would do serverless generate I think it's template AWS Node.js or something, and that will create three files. It creates a serverless YAML file, which is where you define all the configuration for the project. And it will generate a handler.js file, which is like a Hello World Node.js file, which has like a function, which is a Lambda function if you're doing a AWS project, Node.js. And then you have a serverless deploy command, which will then package up all the code and deploy it to AWS or Azure if you have Azure as a output target.
Or Google Cloud platform as well.
Yeah, Google Cloud. Yeah.
Does it default to Amazon?
It does, yeah, but it's like one line of code you need to change in order to use Azure.
And that's in your YAML file that you change where your destination is.
Yeah, YAML files. Like, for example, AWS, there's like settings for what region you use, there's like a setting for what node environment you use. At the moment, they're using 6.10, which is really nice. And you have like functions you define, you know, and then you have like a functions bit on the YAML, and then you have like function name, and that will actually be created on AWS Lambda as a Lambda function. You can have events that are applied to that function, which will be then set up and wired up on the AWS API gateway. You can have like resource targets like DynamoDB, which will then create up the DynamoDB instances on the platform. So this kind of saves you having to like manually go on to the AWS console and create all this stuff, because you can imagine if you had like 400 functions, that would just be like a real drag to do. Now, you don't need, you can automate this stuff without serverless framework. You can download the AWS, I think AWS has its own CLI that you can use. You know, other platforms have their own one. So this serverless is just trying to be like this common place where you could do this sort of stuff.
No, I'm on the serverless.com website, and it says join beta. Is it just like an open beta, or so anybody can, you know, create serverless instances?
No, you can use it now for production, and you just download the framework and off you go. They're at version 1 now.
Oh, okay. Maybe they haven't updated their website. See, I do say version 1 on the front, but it does say join beta on the top.
They're still quite a small team. They just get some... There's some recent round of funding and stuff like that. So I don't know. I think the join beta might be the actual... They have their own cloud platform they're trying to do, but...
Oh, okay. I'm not sure. What's the benefit of a serverless... what's like the benefit of having like a function on AWS or Azure?
Well, in a sense, you're saving money when you're not running any code. So you can imagine imagine you had like peak hours where people would all log in and order something. Like, for example, if you had like a takeaway site, right? So you have all, if you have a big takeaway company, mm-hmm. you have all these, like, if you imagine between working hours, there's not much traffic, and then all of a sudden, 6 o'clock, everybody gets home and wants to order a pizza or something like that. Right. Then you have to have these servers up all the time trying to cope with the demand. Whereas if you're just spinning up functions as a service, then you don't have to have all these servers running. You just need the cloud provider to do that for you. And so you can cope with big spikes but not have to do anything extra in terms of infrastructure. And you get that out of the box.
So would each function, having its own endpoint or having its own URL, would that mean we'd have these... Maybe for one web application, it might have 10 or 20 different functions? Or would we have one function to serve many purposes?
You typically have, I would say, like one function per endpoint and also verb. So you just split up everything into discrete logic.
Okay. So this is not necessarily having all of your logic into one application, but it's having just little chunks of your logic in multiple one-off functions, essentially.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Is there much code? Is there any way to have like code sharing between different functions, or is it pretty much all of the functionality that the function depends on needs to exist in that function?
Well, you don't really want to store any state in the functions. You want to store your state in, you know, things like Amazon S3, DynamoDB.
Sure.
They're kind of stateless functions.
Right.
They're not like pipes, I guess.
You could potentially have a function have a dependency on another function. Would that be true?
I'm not that experienced enough to be able to really comment on that. But basically, you want to think of the functions as pure functions. So you have some input, you have some output, and then there are some differences between AWS and Azure, from what I understand correctly. For example, if in an AWS Lambda function you want to do some DB work, you have to import like the AWS SDK, and you call DB methods from the function directly. Now with Azure, apparently, you don't even need to bother using like an SDK. you can basically pipe output from the functions directly to the database, so you don't, so you're sort of like wiring up things from input output perspective. Now I don't have experience with that with myself, but that's what I heard about it. So I don't know how that looks in a configuration file, but there's an example that we can leave in the show notes that will demonstrate how to do that.
Well, yeah, I think their MS SQL databases already have like built-in endpoints for you to hit, like kind of like you do with Firebase, where you have like a URL to get data. I think that's built into Azure database instances.
Are they using Microsoft MS SQL?
Well, I think you can do MySQL and Postgres in Azure, but MS SQL is the standard because that's a Microsoft product.
Uh huh.
Okay, so I was going to ask you another question, and I just completely forgot. How many functions have you created so far?
Like 4 or 5.
And what kind of things are you doing with them?
I'm just learning how to use it, to be honest.
Yeah. Have you tried sending any like files to a function and processing maybe like resizing images or something like that?
Not yet, but there's an example that shows how to do that. Basically, the example that I'm going to play with, what it does is it provides a React based front end, and you can upload an image of a wine bottle, and you get back like a success if the image is of a wine bottle. So what you're actually using is you're using Amazon's image recognition service, and you're using Microsoft's text reading service, and you're doing that all in the one serverless project. So the idea is you upload a file to, I think it's S3, and then that file in S3 gets processed, and if it contains a wine bottle, it sends off that result to Azure's language, Azure's functionality to read text in a document, so it can actually read labels off the wine bottle image.
That's cool.
Yeah, and then it just returns to Slack the picture and the text, and that's like okay. That's a serverless project that does both Azure and AWS, not in one project, and deploys to them both at the same time, apparently.
Okay, that's interesting. So you could have just completely ignore the idea that you need a web application, and you can have these functions talk to chatbot. You know, have a Slack integration for these functions.
Yeah.
That's cool. Okay, so tell me about the React app. And you have to have a server running that hosts your React app all the time, right? So yeah. Tell me like what that's all about. Do you put that on like Google Pages or GitHub Pages?
Amazon can host static content for you.
Oh, great. So you're not paying much for the static content.
No.
It's just HTML and CSS and JavaScript.
Yeah, yeah. Pretty much. Cool. I don't know how that works with like server-side rendering and functionality, but we're all learning these things, so I'll know more the more I use it.
Right.
And I'm going to be giving probably a talk on it on the... next week, I'll have to be swatting about this stuff, so it's kind of a large meetup. Yeah, so, I was talking about wow. AWS, serverless, and TypeScript.
You better get your thinking that
I've got a habit of doing talks just in time, you know.
Well, I think we've said it before, like, the best way to learn something is to teach it, and
yeah.
now you're, like, you're thrown to the wolves, and you have to learn it.
Yeah.
So, is there authentication? Like, if you wanted to trigger a function, what kind of authentication is there? Is there a JWT token that you have to pass, or is there a query string parameter that you pass, or... like, because your Amazon static content is trying to send data or receive data from a function that's not on the same domain. How does that work?
I'm sure you have all the JWT tokens and whatever authentication you want. So far, I haven't done any of that. I'm just creating these services that yeah. everybody in the world can use. But yeah, eventually, you need to have the authentication.
Right.
And one thing you do have to be really concerned about is security, and you don't want to basically expose your AWS credentials, you know, over GitHub publicly. I heard that
yeah.
within five minutes, you will have some scan bot with those credentials, and you basically have like hundreds of servers mining bitcoins, and then you'll be foot yeah. with a bill.
Yeah, so there's that, and you must also be aware that even though your master branch, the head of your master branch, doesn't have the right authentication or tokens in it, but if you have a previous commit in your history that did have it, just know that is still available to anybody that goes and views your repository yeah. if it's a public one.
Yeah.
So I've done that through my company. It's just gone through all of like our commits and just try to find was there a commit at some point where somebody changed the passwords or changed the secure access tokens or something like that, just to make sure we didn't have anything leak. Obviously, you can request new tokens, and if you do that, you're safe. But if you don't do that and you have the commit in the history, you could potentially pay that pretty big price of, you know, having those servers used as a server farm for yeah. somebody else.
Can you remember the command to do that kind of search and then through a Git history?
Well, if you know exactly which file that yeah. would have those in it,
yeah.
you can go find that file on GitHub and then just go through each commit that file is
all going right, okay.
to.
Okay.
Yeah. That's yeah. one thing that you could do. But I'm sure there's a command to do it.
There's a lot of obscure commands that you just can't memorize.
yeah. No, yeah. But yeah, definitely want to make sure do not commit any secure tokens.
Yeah.
If you can, ignore your config file and then just put a sample config file as the committed one.
Yeah, a lot of the serverless YAML files, they have a lot of environment variables, so you're kind of expected to have this environment config file that you never check in.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's in a gitignore.
Yeah, you know, I don't think gitignore gets as much credit these days, but it saved me quite a bit from committing things that shouldn't. And GitHub has quite a bit of defaults that they, if you, let's see, I think it's github.com. Github.com, GitHub / gitignore. Yeah, they have a project. So github.com/github/gitignore has a project full of different kind of default. I'm going to look for serverless to see if there's one. No, there's not one for serverless, but you could find an AWS one, I'm sure. But anyway, so yeah, check out the GitHub gitignore project. Cool. So you're going to be giving a talk on, it's not just on AWS Lambda, but it's on using AWS for all sorts of things. Tell me more.
It'll be AWS Lambda and serverless and TypeScript.
Oh, okay.
So
I don't know anything about TypeScript. Tell me more about TypeScript. No, I'm just kidding. I love TypeScript.
So I'll just talk about the basics of TypeScript and just demonstrate how to use typings in a Lambda function.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've done this a while back. What I basically did was have a TS config there, and I have my Lambda with the functions in TypeScript, and before I deploy, I just do TSC, and it compiles it to a format that can be deployed on AWS.
Is there in the YAML file? Is there a way to configure that?
No, you just have to do that.
Like a pre-deploy step.
No, you do that. You can do that via npm scripts.
Oh yeah, yeah. So you could do. You could do an NPM script that was called deploy, and then in there you do a TSC double ampersand.
Yeah.
And then call your serverless deploy command.
Yep.
So is serverless installed globally and at the project level, or how does that work?
No, it's globally. It doesn't make any sense to me to why it would be installed locally.
Yeah.
So what it is, depending on the provider. So when you do serverless deploy for an Amazon, it zips up everything, including those modules, which takes sometimes makes it's kind of like 7 megabytes going over to Amazon. And it goes onto this thing called CloudFormation, and that's like Amazon's sort of stack generation templates, and it then uses this CloudFormation template that the serverless framework generates. So this CloudFormation is like the language that of automation that Amazon understands, and that's what basically all that serverless is doing. It's generating this CloudFormation template, sending over all the files that need to run as dependencies for the Lambda functions.
And the CloudFormation template is kind of like scaffolding out the whole instance or whatever that Amazon needs. Okay.
Yeah. Now, with Azure, then it doesn't actually need to package node modules, so it's quicker to deploy, but there is a bit of a delay between the first time it runs because Azure has to download all the dependencies on its side.
Right, yeah. Azure has its own internal deploy system.
All right.
So when you deploy a node package, by default, it will accept all your files, right? So if you did pass over node modules, it would take them. But it's better to let the server get the node modules, especially because you're running on a Windows machine at that point. So there's some node modules that have different binaries that are generated when they're built on a Windows machine versus a Linux machine or a Unix machine.
Yeah.
So it's better to do it on the server that's going to run it. That way you get the right binaries.
There's some things I miss on Windows versus the Mac, but Macs just work with NPM and, you know, Linux-based stuff. I don't know, does Windows have a Linux inside of it now?
Yeah, so I think they're coming out with different flavors of Linux that you can have inside of it, but it defaults... Well, you have to go through a few steps to get it. I'll put a link in the show notes for it, but you have to go through a few steps to get Ubuntu Bash on Windows. So, but yeah, it's there. It's pretty powerful. I mean, it's obviously it's just you type in the word Bash on the command line and you enter a Bash shell.
Yeah.
So it's pretty simple, but you have to know that the node that you had installed on Windows is not the same node that you have installed in Bash. So there's kind of like different, what do they call that, sub modules. Anyway, it's not the same exact instance that you're running off of once you entered Bash.
I think Windows is beating Apple on hardware right now these days.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to tell right now. I've been running on a MacBook Pro for, I'm going to say like 6-7 years now.
Uh-huh.
And for the last 2 years, I've been using Bootcamp to boot into Windows for my day job. So the hardware, Mac's hardware running Windows is really bad.
Really? But
Mac's hardware running Mac OS is super awesome, like sweet, and everything's quick and snappy. Now, if I had like a Surface Book or something like that, I might have a different opinion and think that Microsoft Windows is pretty good. So I don't know.
Apple have been doing some really weird stuff, like this Touch Bar thing. All the professionals just think it's a total gimmick.
It's a gimmick. You know what I do, and I don't have one, so I don't know what it's like. But what I do like the idea is that I'd have the Touch ID on the Mac, which, you know, Windows has that right now. They have the thumbprint on a, if you get like a laptop with the thumbprint doohickey thingamajigger. You can unlock your computer without typing in your password as long as you give it your thumbprint.
Yeah.
So with the Touch Bar having the Touch ID, that sounds interesting. Like I'd be able to unlock it without using my password. But and then maybe also like purchase things on iTunes or purchase things on the App Store without entering my password. I don't know about you, but my password is really long and hard to remember, so using my thumb is more convenient.
So I was camping.
It was great. We did not have a computer or tablet or any devices.
It nice.
Yeah, the our cell phones didn't work anywhere we went. although I did have to use my cell phone for my dog. My dog to sleep at night.
Mm-hmm.
Put on white noise, you know, like so,
really?
Like, a river brook and stuff like that.
Wait. My dog,
he would not be able to sleep at night, and that means none of us would be.
That's the first time I've heard of that.
Yeah.
So, you should make a YouTube video of that. That'd be funny.
Yeah. He's a good dog, but you know, just a little bit of, you know, noise coming from a different campsite or whatever, he'd start barking. So it was good that we had the phones, so we could do that. But yeah, other than that, it was super nice. You know, taking the dog to the lake, he did not want to get out of the water. So that was fun.
What kind of dog is it?
It's an English Springer Spaniel.
All right.
His name is River, and he's 9 months right now, so he's still a puppy, but he's almost full grown.
All right. Yeah, and the spaniels are nice. Our family used to have my auntie, Cocker Spaniel. Lovely dog.
Yeah, I had a Cocker as a kid, and she was great. Like, really friendly, super mellow, you know. But the Springer definitely is not He's not mellow. He's got lots of energy. Yeah, there's a
Yeah.
big difference between the Cocker and the Springer.
Yeah, that Cocker Spaniel would be just going nuts every time somebody came to the door, just and it would keep barking at you
Oh,
until you started to pat it. So, bark.
yeah.
Yeah. Other news. Yeah, I'm still writing my trying to write my novel, sci-fi novel, but I keep like getting to like 1,200 words and then rewriting it because I show it to editors and editors are like, "Nah, this
Oh,
is
really?
too expositional," or like this. But it's I agree with what they're saying. Basically, what I was doing, I was trying to be too descriptive in what I was writing, but they wanted to. The reader to discover through the main character what was happening, so not like when the editor says this feels like an exercise in exposition. So I'm like, yeah, describing all these things happening, like, but yeah, just let the user experience it, the reader user let the reader experience for themselves, you know. And it's actually more fun to write that way as well. So
Yeah.
instead of saying Jack sat in the carriage, it was full of commuters and all that stuff. You say it from like a third person perspective. On Jack was feeling, frustrated with the noise and the clustering of people around him. He looked around and he saw that kind of style, and it's more
Yep.
fun to write that way.
Yeah, and like usually you put like what the destination is like in paragraph three. You don't even know where Jack's going for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that's. I'm excited to see. I haven't read any of it, so I'll have to get into it again. Check it out.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, other news with me. So I am making a career switch and start a new job next week. I'll be working at
Cool.
Nike, and
Congratulations, man.
yeah, it's super exciting. I'm gonna miss all the guys I work with right now, but they're gonna be really close. Where the Nike headquarters is pretty
All right.
close to the new office that
Sweet.
the company I'm working for right now. They're moving to Beaverton, Oregon, which is just the same, or it's almost to Beaverton, and it's just a couple of miles away from where I'll be. So,
Is that Nike headquarters for the world?
yeah, it's world headquarters. Yep,
Whoa,
it's a
sheesh.
huge campus.
Can you
Yeah.
like get like some special small stitching and then like put the podcast URL on the trainers, like just like so that people
Yeah, I will do that. I'll put stickers in all the boxes. So yeah, I'm excited. Looking forward to working with a new group of guys. And one thing that I'm really mostly excited about is the ability to like get immersed in a TDD workflow. And we've tried it at my current job, but because we're a small consultancy, it's hard to justify the let's write a whole bunch of tests before we actually write any code.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to getting into that world and seeing what it's like. I've struggled with it on my own projects, so I'm hoping that with it kind of being the mandate, that it'll be fun and challenging at the same time.
Yeah.
So I think that's about it. That's all we have for this episode. So
Okay.
it was fun talking to you again, Nikos,
Yeah, good to catch
and
up.
thanks everyone for listening to Learn With Us. You can find us on Twitter at Learn With Us Pod, and be sure to leave a 5-star review on iTunes. Nothing else will do.
Muchas
And
gracias.
we'll see you next week.
Yep. And we'll have
Take care.
something interesting to talk about then as well. So whatever that will be what it will be.
Yes. Stay tuned.
See you guys.
Bye.
And that's a wrap.
Each failure is a step closer to success. Ugh. Hold on. that was one step closer to success.